Hello and welcome to the Painting Podcast. I'm your host, Jeremiah Polacek, your co-pilot on the pathway to becoming a better painter, or just a better art lover in general. Today we're going to be talking about performative painting. How long have people been watching people paint? And why should we watch people paint? Is it interesting? Do we learn something from watching people paint? Or is it just mind-numbing ASMR entertainment? Let's get into it. Imagine that you're in a cave with a flickering fire and you're huddled close to the cave wall and you look up and there's a person whose hands have been stained by countless colors that were extracted from the earth itself. There's ochres, there's charcoals, and there's whites. He's got a palette. He's spitting the paint onto the wall and covering his hands with it and leaving the imprint of his hand on the wall. He's also painted a lot of different animals. There's bison with their hunched backs. There's a deer caught in a mid-leap. And as the fire flickers, it seems as if all the animals are coming to life, their legs slowly moving to the pattern and the flickering of the flame. You look at this person painting on the wall, and you too want to paint on the wall. You want to learn how he's doing it. How does he grind up those pigments to make color? How does he put them into his mouth? How does he spit them out onto the wall? Then the person comes over to you and shows you how. You pick up a piece of a burnt stick with the end black like charcoal, and you begin to scratch your own bison into the wall. No, not like that, the person says. More like this. And you watch and you emulate that same bison. We're talking about the Lascaux Caves, and that was just a made-up story. I don't know if that happened. We don't know a lot about the Lascaux Caves. But one thing we do know in looking at all the images is that there is a stylistic unity among them. There's a similarity in how they're painted and how they're created, which lends us to believe that it's likely that this certain way of painting was passed down from one person to another. This isn't uncommon. If we look at a lot of antiquity or prehistoric art, we'll see very complicated patterns emerge time and time again. It comes up in weaving and rugs, whether it's Persian rugs or those created by Navajos. It's all over the world. And there has to be a way to transmit this information on how to create, because within these creations also lies a lot of a culture's stories, beliefs, and ideas. In this instance, it wasn't one artist that was teaching their technique. It was an entire community. These techniques had developed through generations. This was a tradition that would often be passed down in families. So children literally grew up watching how to make stuff, and then they just made it. It was kind of natural for them. This is a form of observed learning, and this mode of learning ensures that the craft is not merely preserved as some sort of set of techniques, but it's also a living tradition that carries the history, values, and aesthetics of the people. So while the basics of the craft were often taught through observation, an individual weaver would sometimes be encouraged to innovate and express their own personal vision within the creation. This would allow the tradition to evolve over time, but still stay rooted in its origins. But again, we're talking about something that I'll call observed learning. How do you do that? Oh, you put the needle down here, then you bring it up here, then you put it back down. Okay, I know how to do that. In a lot of ways, this probably goes to the origin of teaching. And while a lot is not known about when teaching began, we know when schools began, right? We know when the idea of a school came into existence. It would be the Sumerian culture around 3000 BC. And most of this would be dedicated to the art of writing. You know, there was a lot of scribes. Same thing happened in China around 2000 BC, as well as ancient Egypt. And these were kind of formal schools that you could go to and learn something. But I'm not talking about those formal schools. I'm talking about just one person looking at their mom doing something and then emulating it. That's also a form of teaching. And it's also a form of looking and then recreating what is being looked at. So it's important to distinguish between an ancient educational system, such as what we see in Sumer or ancient Greece with their academies, these sorts of things, and what would become the idea of apprenticeship. And we know a lot about apprenticeship in painting, right? We know some famous apprentices. Raphael would be one. An apprenticeship concentrated on a specific trade or craft. Doesn't have to be painting necessarily. It could be being a blacksmith or being a carpenter, making rugs, all sorts of different things. And the focus of these was on acquiring some sort of a practical skill or knowledge that would directly relate to a profession. The goal was becoming a master craftsman, right? And so, you know, while the method of instruction of a lot of ancient education systems, this would employ a variety of different teaching methods that would include oral instruction, copying texts, memorization. In places like ancient Greece, there would be a lot of emphasis on dialogue and debate as well. But apprenticeship would rely heavily on hands-on experiences and observation. Apprentices learned by doing and watching and working alongside a master craftsman in order to gain the skills through the direct practice of it in the studio. In this respect, an apprentice has a lot more in common with the person who's looking at their mother and learning how to weave than they do with some sort of ancient educational system where they're taught more formally in repetition and regurgitating certain facts and these sorts of things. Here they're doing and they're making. And when we look back in time, we often think of painters as being this kind of mysterious force within a community, kind of like a visionary or a shaman, but in many instances, they would just be seen as a regular person, similar to a cabinet baker. Of course, there was great, you know, epic painters that we all remember, and Michelangelo and these types of people, prodigal talent, but there's also hundreds and thousands of other painters who were just creating the normal work for the small little cathedral down the road. So painting was a trade in itself, right? So it had more in common with cabinet making than it did with something like literature in many respects. And a lot of times people aren't aware that an academy in ancient Greece, for example, the goal wasn't necessarily one specific thing. With apprenticeship, you're studying one specific thing. I want to learn how to paint. And then you go to a master's studio or workshop, and that's where you learn how to paint. That's different than going to an academy where you're taking some philosophy courses, taking some mathematic courses. They weren't quite sure where you're going to end up in a lot of respects. It's kind of like your general eds in a certain way, right? That's the origin of the academic model. But with apprenticeship, as I said, you're working directly with one person, so you better like them. Another aspect to this was there's a certain social status, as there is today, that differentiates between people that work with their hands and people that work with their minds. And this goes back thousands and thousands of years as well. So if you wanted to get into an academy in ancient Greece, it was highly unlikely that you would do so if you were from a poor family. You're probably not going to get in. You're not part of the club. But if you showed talent at a young age and you found the right master craftsman to work with, he might take your kid and teach him something. And at the end of the day, becoming a painter for the cathedral down the road would be similar to becoming an electrician or something like that today. It's a stable job that likely will result in a pretty stable source of income. So for poor people, becoming a painter seemed like a great option. They could work with their hands, they could weasel their way into an apprenticeship, and then they had to watch and rely on their body and their arm to mimic these movements, and hopefully some magic would come out as a result, and maybe they'd win the lottery and have some sort of natural talent that would propel them to greatness. We can think of somebody like Raphael, whose dad was actually a court painter, by the way. But Raphael was notoriously better than the master artist which he was working with. By the time he was like 13 or 14, he was just like, I give up. I can't do this anymore. This 13-year-old is upstaging me. I'm done. Go out and, you know, work for the Pope already. See ya. But for Raphael, that worked out awesome, right? Because he came from kind of like a normal working class family, while his dad did have connections to the art world and these sorts of things. But his ability to paint propelled him to greatness, it propelled him to fame, and he got a lot of money too. So Raphael really represents somebody who watched their father paint, who had the tradition passed down to him through his own observation of watching his father and his techniques. But then he mastered these techniques rather quickly upon doing an apprenticeship, and the old cliche still stands, the student had become the master. But Raphael himself had to have that access to watching somebody create and watching somebody make in order to learn. So there was a certain privilege that came with him being born to a painter. He got to see that from a very young age. Today, with YouTube, we have access to thousands and thousands of different tutorials, millions of different tutorials. I sound like Donald Trump now. Millions and billions and billions. But anyway, we have access to an seemingly unending stream of tutorials on everything from how to fix your toilet to, you know, how to install flooring in your house. We can watch people do all sorts of things. And one thing that researchers have discovered is that when people watch somebody do something, they begin to become confident that they too can do it themselves. This was actually the part of six different studies that were detailed in the journal Psychological Science, and the research explored this theory that individuals tend to be very confident about how their skills have got better just by observation of others doing the same task. So how can somebody get better just by watching videos? That's pretty much what this study was looking into. And in a particular one that they did, they took 193 students from the University of Chicago, and they asked them to participate in a dart-throwing experiment in the laboratory. So initially, these participants were shown a video clip that would show somebody who was really, really good at darts hitting a bullseye over and over again, and this video was played once or 20 times, and then they categorized the participants into two groups, predictors and performers. The predictors were asked to gauge the number of points they believed that they could score on a scale of 0 to 100 with a single dart throw at that moment. Their predictions were then measured against the actual performance of the performers who executed a single dart throw. What was interesting about it was that the predictors, exposed to the expert demonstration 20 times, anticipated achieving a higher score compared to those who saw the demonstration only once. So basically, the more times you watch somebody do something, the more confident you get in being able to do it. But they did this in a couple other studies as well. Perhaps this was just an outlier with darts, right? So they did another one with the moonwalk, and they got 100 people, both, you know, university students and residents from Chicago, and they had them all watch an expert doing the moonwalk. They did the same thing. They randomly assigned people to view a video of the moonwalk either once or 20 times in succession. After watching, participants predicted their moonwalking abilities, and then they had to try the dance move themselves. And I wish I would have been there. I'm sure it would have been hilarious. Their performances are actually recorded, and then they were assessed by a panel of judges who were experts on the moonwalk to determine how good they are at moonwalking. And consistently with the other findings, they found the people that watched the demonstration 20 times were much more confident in their ability to moonwalk than the actual performance would show. And the people that, you know, only watched the video once were kind of like, okay, I don't know what I'm doing. But the more you watch it, the more they think they know how to do it. So just watching something is not enough in many of these instances. When I was talking about it before, the person watching, you know, somebody making a Persian rug, something very complicated where you have a needle going up and down and all these different ways, somebody who's watching that can't possibly take in all that information and intellectualize it in their mind and just remember it. They have to do it at the same time. They have to screw up. Oh, no, it doesn't go down like that. Oh, if you're doing the moonwalk, oh, you're not lifting your heel the right way. You got to move your heel this way. You're moving your foot the wrong way. That's why we have instructors that correct people in this. And we kind of live in this age where we're now awash in all these tutorial videos, like I said before, especially about painting. I make these videos, by the way. So I'm part of the problem, I guess. But we have people that watch these videos and they think by watching these videos, they're going to somehow magically become better without practice. But practice combined with observation is what actually makes somebody learn something. So in terms of observational learning and painting and why people watch people paint, there's certainly this aspect of learning at play. It's designed to instruct. But there's another type of observational painting, not observation. I don't know what to call it. People watching people paint, that should be explored as well. Because you would have court painters, you know, in the during the Renaissance, probably before that as well, I have no idea. But you would have court painters during the Renaissance that would also create paintings, and people would come and actually watch them create the work. They were considered part of, you know, an event or part of some sort of cultural experience in some way. And people could, you know, for instance, hear somebody playing a harp in one room of the castle, and then in another room, there's somebody making a portrait or something like this. So painters were seen as people that are kind of creating magic, and people were naturally drawn to watching people smear these pigments around on a canvas because there's kind of a magical quality to it. They don't know how to do it. They're not necessarily interested in learning how to do it, but they like watching it. And this brings up a really difficult question called, you know, regarding something called in situ. And in situ basically just means what's the stuff around a painting, right? It comes from Latin and it translates to in position. Within art, it refers to works that are specifically made for, or at least taken to consideration, the end location for the installation, display, or exhibition of the work itself. Usually these works try to harmonize somehow with the environment that they're in. Sometimes it would be relating to architectural elements that are in a room, or maybe even architectural, you know, elements of the frame itself. So this could be, you know, an altarpiece, a sculpture, a fresco, all these certain sorts of things. So we're thinking about paintings that go a certain place. So if we're talking about an in situ painting that involves people observing the painting itself, the act of painting becomes a performance of sort. And this performance goes back centuries. Like I said, you would walk through the castle, and perhaps there is the court painter doing his thing. And oh, how nice it is to watch them paint. In this regard, the painting itself, like I said, is part of a performance. And if we're talking about in situ, we're talking about how is that painting being crafted for the environment that it's in. I don't know this for sure, but I imagine when you have an audience, perhaps you change the way you paint a little bit. When that audience came in to watch somebody paint in a castle, did they continue to paint in exactly the same way as they had before? I don't know the answer, but I'm guessing yes. So let's fast forward a couple centuries and place ourselves in a studio in New York, and it's got some old, worn wooden floors that are covered with paint splatters all over them. We see a flash bulb illuminate the room, and there's a photographer from Life magazine who's taking pictures of Jackson Pollock dripping on his canvas. In this regard, we see the artist at work in his studio making these drip paintings. A lot of this probably dealt with the public fascination of Jackson Pollock and how odd his work seemed to most. This is where a lot of the "my kid could do that" likely came from during this time. He's just dripping on a canvas, right? So it's kind of a spectacle what he's doing. He's being made fun of for doing it in a lot of ways. But that photographer from Life magazine who comes and photographs him in the process of creating one of his paintings is also kind of acting in the same way that an audience member coming to observe a court painter would. They're looking at the process of the work itself in the place where the work is being made. His studio, and the cans of paint on the wall, the floors, the walls, the brushes, everything speaks to this mode of creation. The canvas itself is on the ground. It's not on an easel. He just puts it on the ground, and then he drips from up on top. And then somebody taking a video, instead of taking photographs of him, would place the camera underneath a piece of glass so they could act as if they were behind the canvas, looking up at Jackson Pollock's paint being dripped down on top of them. In this regard, the video itself becomes a work of art. It's different than the painting. It's a video of a painting. So this would take place in 1949, and part of this was coupled, like I said, with the media frenzy of an artist and the mass media being able to really propel an artist, partially because of his strangeness to the general public, But a lot of people suddenly know who Jackson Pollock is. And when we watch him paint, there's something kind of beautiful just about watching that paint drop down onto the canvas. We can make fun of the result, that it's a bunch of splatters or whatever, but for some reason, people are still captivated by those images. Around 10 years later, Picasso would make a film with the French director, let me try to get his name right, Henri Clouzot. And he would make a movie called The Mystery of Picasso. And in that film, it's great, you can find it on YouTube. I encourage everyone to go hunt it down. The Mystery of Picasso by Clouzot. And in this, there's a segment where Picasso only has 90 seconds, and he also has a piece of glass, which the camera is looking through, so we can kind of see Picasso create. And it starts off with Picasso creating this image of a rooster, and Clouzot is, you know, making some drama, saying, okay, we got 90 seconds left, you got 90 seconds, you've got to do this. So there's kind of this element of play involved. There's this, you know, known element of performativity, because of course Clouzot could have, you know, just put another piece of film on the reel or whatever and continued filming it, but he wanted to add some drama to the event. And so Picasso starts off and he's making this rooster, and you know, Clouzot is like 30 seconds left, and then he's getting less and less time, and then Picasso changes everything and he blacks out a big part and he turns it into a woman's face instead at the end, and he puts it down, and that is that. So in this respect, the act of painting itself is kind of a game, it's kind of a performance for an audience, and there's this added element of drama at play. This is also playing into the same idea of watching somebody paint as entertainment. And these were videos. They were meant to be watched, you know, on television, or they'd be projected, or whatever they did back in the day. But these were videos or photographs of people painting. The artist Yves Klein would further this idea when he would seek to transcend a lot of the traditional boundaries that we saw in painting and the performance of painting, and he would create performances of him painting. And he would add to this spectacle of the audience coming to watch somebody paint by using the human body as a paintbrush himself. He only got female models, which obviously there's a lot of criticism which can be lodged because he used female models and very particular types of bodies of female models, and he referred them as living brushes, which, you know, you might want to revise that in the 21st century. Anyway, he covered them with his signature color, which was International Klein Blue, and then he would press them or roll their bodies against these canvases that he had. And this would take place during a performance, which was often public. So he would turn the act of painting into a sort of theatrical event. And one of the most famous of these performances took place on March 9th, 1960, at the International Contemporary Art Fair in Paris. And everybody in the audience is dressed up nicely, right? Everybody's got their, you know, tuxedos on and formal dress and all this sort of things. And then Klein also had a symphony in the room. He's got all these naked women. He's got canvases strewn about onto the floor. And he has the symphony play a piece that Klein himself wrote called the Monotone Symphony. And it's a single note played for 20 minutes, followed by 20 minutes of silence. Klein, who was also dressed in a tuxedo at this event, would orchestrate the model's movements across the canvas and kind of play a conductor with the live painting. The resulting artworks were known as these things called anthropometries. And it kind of captured this impression of the human body and Klein's, you know, signature color, International Klein Blue. Sometimes they would be more abstract impressions of the human form, and sometimes they would be more defined figurative representations of the bodies. They would be imprints on the canvas, similar to these hands that we saw in the cave walls at the beginning of this episode. But there's no doubt that when Klein was making this piece, he wanted it to be seen as a performance. Do the resulting paintings really matter that much, or was it the performative aspect that was the art itself? Of course, people still love these paintings and they're artifacts of the event, and they're probably worth millions and millions of dollars. But to Klein, I think the performance was the important part. The bodies, the living paintbrushes, his blue, his symphony, the event, the rich people in their fancy dress watching it all unfold, that was the art. And the artwork left over was the artifact of that event. So this is different than watching somebody paint and learning what they paint and how they paint. And it's also different than wandering around the castle and stumbling upon the court painter making a painting and watching them paint. This is an event that is designed for people to watch the experience of painting. It's more similar to the Picasso video in The Mystery of Picasso, or the pictures of Jackson Pollock, or video of Jackson Pollock painting. The event of painting itself is what's important. And this is admittedly a very highbrow event, right? It's taking place at a contemporary art fair. So when they go high, I go low. Let's go low. Bob Ross. Everybody loves watching Bob Ross, pretty much. He's got a pet squirrel. How can you not like him, right? But for some reason, Bob Ross becomes extremely popular in the late 70s and 1980s through his painting show, The Joy of Painting, where people from all over the country would watch him paint these very idyllic landscapes. And in watching Bob Ross, there was that certain magic. It's kind of similar to watching the court painter paint. It's definitely not like watching Eve Klein drag some women across a canvas. But when we're watching Bob Ross paint, we like to see the magic. We like to see him make that gradient so quickly for that sunset and then just chop in those mountains. How does he do that? And he invites you to paint along with him. That's something different as well. So we're getting into this idea of tutorials, performative aspects, people wanting to see the magic unfold, but also that element of learning is still there because Bob Ross has invited the viewer. He even speaks directly to them. He tells them, this is the paints that I have. I've got titanium white. I've got cadmium yellow. This is how you set up your palette. And he's very encouraging. That's one thing people really like about him. He has no highbrow sensibilities that are keeping people away from coming to his videos and experiencing them. And in the creation of his work, he hopes to make something in somebody else's house as well. And I'm sure there are, you know, millions of Bob Ross paintings across the planet of people who've watched Bob Ross and painted with him. And this idea of painting with somebody still exists slightly today, but I think in the YouTube generation, we've got another form of video, and we can look at the artist Nicolas Uribe and his series, Our Painted Lives, which I would advise everyone to go check out on YouTube as well. But he'll give us an incredible amount of information which shows how he creates his works. We're not encouraged to paint along with him, but we can see the development of the work from beginning to end. And oftentimes he'll speed these up, so it's a time-lapse effect. And then he'll narrate over, giving us an overview of what he's doing, what types of color decisions he's thinking about, all these sorts of things, thoughts about art history. And it's kind of more of a free-form podcast that is, you know, put on top of this time-lapse video of him creating, as well as doing live streams. Live streams are part of this as well, so you have, you know, audience interactivity and these sorts of things. This is kind of the long format video that is becoming more and more common on YouTube. There's the tutorial that tells you this is how you do something. And then there's the video, which is more long form, and we, you know, get to see the artist making a work like you're doing right now, maybe. But, you know, part of his audience, it's impossible to determine, I think, how many of his audience members are watching him paint because they want to learn how to paint, and how many people are watching just because they like to watch it. They like the sounds associated it with it, and they just like to watch it made. And this is kind of similar to a lot of what's called ASMR videos. And if you're unfamiliar with ASMR videos, they tend to be these videos with very exaggerated sounds, and they involve squishing things and very satisfying elements. They're just fun to watch. And painting is kind of ripe for these ASMR videos because painting is known as a solitary activity, and there's kind of scrubbing noises, and there's the little tinkling of you cleaning your brush, these sorts of sounds. And that itself can also be soothing. So there's some ASMR videos that are devoted almost solely to the sounds involved in painting. If you looked at the artist Bijuju on Instagram or TikTok, you'll see that he's making these like minute to 90 second long videos of him creating, but the sound is very important in these videos. You know, watching the painting develop is nice, but a lot of people come for that sound, that. And he even makes his own soundtracks for these videos as well. And I'm sure there's an element of the algorithm coming into play as well, where somebody who's creating these sorts of videos suddenly learns this is about how long this video should be to get, you know, this type of reaction and these types of views. This is how long I can hold somebody's attention. I need to start it with, you know, a hook, the same way they start, you know, all these other TikTok videos. They start it with something exciting so you don't just swipe off. So oftentimes these videos will have some sort of dramatic intro. You know, they have the splat of the paint right in the beginning just to get somebody's attention, and hopefully they can hold it for more than 2 seconds. But in this regard, the algorithm is shaping the way the video is created. But when you shape the way a video is created, when you're creating an artwork, you're also using the algorithm to shape the way a painting is created as well. So I would like to propose that the creation of these new TikTok videos that are geared towards, you know, watching somebody create a painting are also a new form of algorithmic creation in the final production of the work itself. In a way, the TikTok algorithm is actually pushing the painting in certain directions. The end result of that painting looks the way it does because of TikTok's algorithm. And TikTok's algorithm is also based on audience retention and how long people watch things. So in a way, we're kind of going back to the person wandering around the castle and stumbling upon the portrait painter making a portrait, because there's this desire to just watch people create and this desire to watch people make. TikTok might have figured out that 6.5 second videos involving these sorts of elements and even these sorts of color are more popular. But at its heart, it's still people wanting to watch people make stuff. And if you're one of those people that likes watching people make stuff, I invite you, first of all, go to my TikTok at Jeremiah Polacek or Oko Academy on YouTube, and you can find a ton of videos of me painting. But more than that, I hope that when you're watching these videos of people painting, you can feel rest assured that you're actually engaging in a form of participation that's existed for thousands of years. If you're into this sort of thing, head on over to Oko.academy, which is my tiny little art school in Prague, where I teach painting and drawing from my own contemporary standpoint, where I'm emphasizing the fundamentals, but also developing the artist and their own personal vision as well. Head on over to the website. You can come to Prague and you can come take a class with me in real life, or we can work out something online. Hit me up in an email. Thanks a lot for listening, and as always, happy painting.